Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Reporting Clearly and Accurately About Disability conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, you may press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Robin Jones. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Great, and thank you. And again, welcome everyone to today's session, and I'm glad that you were able to join us. And I know that the information we are going to be providing you today will be very valuable to you. This program is brought to you as part of a program known as the ADA Audio Conference Series, which is a program of the ADA National Network, which are Information and Technical Assistance Centers on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Our session today has been coordinated by Cornell University, which hosts Northeast ADA Center and the Great Lakes ADA Center located at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The individuals are participating today in a variety of different ways. We have some people who are on the telephone, and we have some people who are on the webinar platform, and some that might be actually doing both. So as you heard in my earlier comments, please feel free to enter your questions into the webinar chat area if you're on the webinar platform. And for those of you on the telephone, please hold your questions until we have the operator give you instructions on how to ask your questions, and or you can send them by email at webinars@ada-audio.org, and we'll convey them to the speakers at that time. At this point, I'd like to introduce Hannah Rudstrom from Cornell University, who is also affiliated with the Northeast ADA Center, and she will be our lead for today's session and introduce our other presenters. So, Hannah, I'm going to hand the microphone over to you at this time.
Thank you so much, Robin, and thank you, Robin, for hosting us for this session, and thank you for all of your efforts in helping us to plan this as we went along. And most of all, thank all of you who are joining us today. I'd like to present my co-authors of this presentation. As you can well guess, this was not something, even though you're hearing me speak, this was very much of a collaborative effort. We had many people involved in this. I'd like to thank Wendy Gower, who's the Northeast ADA Center Director at Cornell University, Mary Katt, who's the Assistant Director of Communications and Marketing at Cornell's ILR School, Peter Quinn, who works at the Yang and Tang Employment and Disability Institute as the Multimedia Specialist there, and Dot Marinaccio, who works at Access VR in New York State, and is the Regional Business Relations Coordinator. I want to particularly thank Dot for getting the idea for this session and for kind of instigating this session. She really played a key role in both generating the idea for this program, but also all along as we were developing the plan and reaching out to participants. I also want to thank Mary Katt for her great ideas and for really bringing that journalist perspective to the work, and of course Peter Quinn for also bringing that journalist perspective and also for being a panelist. So just a little background of how we kind of came upon this session and what our thoughts were. This session emerged from our experience with how disability is portrayed in the media. As you all know, words and images are powerful. They matter. They're often powerful in shaping the automatic assumptions that the public brings to these types of issues. And these automatic assumptions about disability are not only often wrong, they hurt people, and they hurt people with disabilities. Journalists and media professionals sometimes use language and assumptions about disability that are not only not quite legal, but also not accurate and sometimes not respectful. So we wanted to start an effort to give media professionals both some quick points that they can use in reporting about disability, but we also wanted to start a conversation in the journalist community long term about the connection between the language used to describe disability and the automatic assumptions about people with disabilities that this language can evoke. So on the next slide, you will see, hopefully when we get the next slide, you will see our partners. Robin already mentioned the great role and the sponsorship of the Great Lakes ADA Center. the North, and also the Northeast ADA Center, which is now part of the Yang and Tan Employment and Disability Institute at Cornell University. I already mentioned AccessVR, and I will be mentioning soon John Robinson's great new business called Our Ability, and we'll be talking more about that in just 1 second. On the next slide, we see an 800 number that you can call if you are a journalist and you have any questions about how to report about disability, or if you have any questions about any aspect of the ADA or any aspect of disability. Here is an 800 toll-free number where it's very likely, just to remember what it was like, call this number, because it's very likely you're actually going to reach a living, breathing person to talk about these issues, to talk about an expert about any of the issues that we'll be talking about today. So do give us a call if you have any questions about these issues. On the next slide, we'll be showing that a little bit later. You'll be meeting our panelists for this presentation. For now, I'd just like to have you quickly meet them. We have John Robinson, who's the president of Our Ability, Inc. We have Allison Weiner-Heinemann, who's a lecturer at the Department of Labor Relations, Law and History at the ILR School at Cornell. And we have Peter Quinn, who's a multimedia specialist at the Yan and Tang Employment Disability Institute at Cornell University. So more of an elaborate introduction of our panelists later, but for now I think we'll dive right into our program. So if we could have the next slide. Here we see I mentioned the two goals that we have with this session. Part one, which is going to be about 30 minutes long, reflects the first goal. And what we want to do in part one is provide reporters with a quick set of guidelines to use when reporting about disability. Those of you who only want these quick points may have a jumping off point in about 30 minutes from now. If you feel like that's all you need and you don't want the deeper discussion of the panel, but we really hope all of you will continue to be with us for part two as well. In part two, we'll go into a deeper and kind of a more spontaneous discussion of these issues with our panelists. They'll discuss both their own experiences with these issues as well as what they see as emerging issues and how disability is reported in the media. But throughout, we'd really like your comments, your thoughts, and your questions. We would like this, as Robin mentioned, to be an interactive session. So we will be taking a little break after both parts one and part two to discuss your comments and your questions. So as we go along, as we said, please enter your thoughts and questions into the question box, and we will all of us be discussing them at that time. So as we go to the next slide, we thought we'd start with a little overview. As you can see from the numbers on this slide, disability is one of the largest diversity populations in our country today, with nearly 57 million people and about 20% of the U.S. population. So what's also very important on this slide is the fact that disability is a growing diversity population in our country today for a variety of reasons. With better treatments and with less shame, thankfully, more people with disabilities are now meaningfully able to participate in our communities, our businesses, our schools, our colleges, and our workplace. The most prominent of the reasons for the growing number of people with disabilities in our country is the aging of our population. With the numbers of people with disabilities in our country, I think it's always been surprising to the extent to which the disability is often sort of relegated as the sort of forgotten aunt of diversity awareness and planning efforts. Too often, diversity plans for our communities, our workplaces, and other venues of life sort of treat disability as an afterthought. Another point that's also given on the slides, many disabilities are not obvious to others. In fact, arguably the majority of people with disabilities who have rights under the ADA have disabilities that are not obvious to others. So just a few points there. On the next slide, we see here what we mean by the fact that automatic assumptions and attitudes around disabilities do hurt people with disabilities. So Robin, if you could give us the next slide. here are, see, we have some basic statistics around employment levels for people with disabilities. And again, if you want more information with this on this, I urge you to look at the references that are given on the slide, or just call our 800 number and we can give you more information on this. We see here that even with 25 years of ADA protections, the ADA was passed in 1990. We see that people with disabilities still do face significant discrimination, particularly in their economic and employment lives. The employment rate for people with disabilities has been, unfortunately, largely unchanged since 1990. The percent of people with disabilities with employment remains about half that of people without disabilities, as you see here by the statistics given on the slide. In 2013, the full-time, full-year employment rate for people with disabilities was 20.9%, and for people without disabilities was 56.4%. Too often, we assume that these statistics are because people with disabilities either can't or don't want to work. But this is most certainly not borne out by the evidence. And again, the evidence is given at the bottom of the slide, the citation. We see here that about 70% of people with disabilities do want to work and are actively striving to work. There's also significant evidence from, among other sources, DePaul University and DuPont studies that show that when people with disabilities are given the opportunity to work, they do perform as well as those without disabilities and are as productive. These disappointing findings point to another fact, clearly supported by the research, that the biggest barrier people with disabilities face is usually not the disability itself. They have learned to cope with the disability usually long ago. Rather, the biggest barrier people with disabilities face is often the attitudes of others, and in particular, the attitudes of employers. So on our next slide, we will kind of shift gears here. If we can have the next slide. And we see here that while the previous slides gave a little quick background on the challenges faced by people with disabilities, we're now going to be providing you with a quick overview of the kind of the five main things that media professionals need to know when reporting about people with disabilities. So let's start with these five. On the next slide, the first of these, what we're calling these nuts and bolts points, very basic points, has to do with words and language. Being journalists and media professionals, I'm sure I don't have to remind any of you folks in the audience that words do matter. So our first point has to do with using person-first language, what we call person-first language. Basically, person-first language means that we're using words that focus our attention not primarily on the disability, but instead on the person. When we use words like the disabled or the handicapped, we're focusing virtually all our attention on the disability, and the person behind the disability too often is eclipsed. Is kind of conceptually lost when we use language that focuses instead on only the disability. So on the next slide, we have some examples of phrases to avoid because they are disability first instead of person first. These phrases are not you know, weird or strange, but are pretty much still part of our common parlance around disability. So as I read them, ask yourself what images and assumptions these phrases evoke for you. Here are the examples. How do the disabled fare when traveling on airplanes? The paraplegic was forced to crawl up the stairs to the courthouse. Epileptics now can do almost anything other people can do. Many insane people have been forced to live on streets after deinstitutionalization. And finally, how can museums help the blind to learn about their world? So just think of what sort of image these phrases evoke for you. You may notice we didn't use the word handicap here, but I'd like to talk about that a little bit. The word handicapped is a classic example of the power of language. Though some linguists disagree, it's likely that the word handicapped historically referred to the utter powerlessness of people with disabilities, that it emerged to describe people who had to live with their hand in their cap, hence the word handicap, begging in the street. Because this word harkens back to a time of utter powerlessness for many people with disabilities, it's considered offensive in the disability community. So even though we still we hear the word like handicapped parking, it's better to replace the word handicapped with accessible, as in using accessible parking. So continuing to the next slide, we can see here, by contrast, what assumptions and images do these other phrases evoke, these alternative phrases? With just a simple change of phrase, we're more likely to see the person instead of just the disability. Here's the examples given on the slide. How do people with disabilities stare when traveling on an airplane? A man who uses a wheelchair was forced to crawl up the stairs to the courthouse. People with seizure disorders can do almost anything other people can do too. People with psychiatric disability have been forced to live on the streets after deinstitutionalization. How can museums help people with visual disabilities to learn about their words, their world? So even though it's a little longer to say, we like to use the phrase person with a disability or individual with a disability instead of the disabled or the handicapped. And you can see that idea sort of carried through with the statements on this slide. So going on to the next slide, so building upon this first point, here we unpack some of the automatic assumptions that sort of follow the all too commonly used phrase, the disabled, or the paraplegic, or the blind. It's made all about the disability. It also implies that people with disabilities are all alike. It sort of lumps them together under one category. That phrase often eclipses their talents, their likes, their dislikes, and their achievement. All of these things take a backseat to that disability status. So that's why we're trying to avoid disability first language and trying to use person first language. If we go on to the next slide, we see our second point in reporting about disability, be careful to avoid the automatic assumption that the person is or sees herself as a victim. The very word victim brings up images of people who have been powerless and are unable to control their lives. On the next slide, we're looking again at a few more commonly used phrases. You might see these phrases in as headlines or something like that in journalism. Let's look at a few more commonly used phrases that focus on this victim mentality. The man in question is confined to a wheelchair. The teacher who was named in the suit suffers from epilepsy. Two of the children in the family are cripples. The doctor, who is herself a stroke victim, pledges to make life better for people like her. And finally, when he communicates, he is bound to a wheelchair. So these phrases, apart from just being wrong on a moral level, these phrases are wrong on an accuracy level too. They're just plain wrong. How do we know that someone who uses a wheelchair feels themselves to be confined? Many people who use wheelchairs don't feel themselves to be confined. How do we know that someone who uses a computer or an assistive device to communicate feels that they're quote-unquote bound to or limited by this? Many people who use these devices could feel that they're actually better able to communicate than those who don't use the device. So be careful of phraseology and language that implies victimhood. All these phrases make huge assumptions that are often inaccurate about how the person experiences their disability. These assumptions then can be wrong on both a moral and a factual level. So if we go to the next slide, We see, by comparison, how do these phrases sound and sort of what kind of images do they conjure? We'll see here in the phrases that I'm about to read that these neutral phrases don't make the same sort of assumptions about how the person with a disability is experiencing their disability. The man in question uses a wheelchair. The teacher who was named in the suit has a seizure disorder. Two of the children in the family use mobility devices. The doctor who has had a stroke herself pledges to make life better for others who have had strokes. And finally, he uses a computer when communicating. So we see here that these phrases are both more neutral and more accurate. If we go to the next slide, we see here that there are just some phrases and some words that just generally should be avoided in all situations. Let's start with the word normal as opposed to disabled. We often hear that word in contradistinction to disabled. When we refer to people without disabilities as normal, we're segregating people with disabilities as somehow being less than human, as being abnormal, as not deserving of being integrated with quote-unquote normal society. So that word is problematic for that reason. We've already talked about the word handicapped and how this harkens back historically to a time of utter powerlessness. The word retarded, now called the R word, has been dropped because of its loading of negativity and segregation. The term intellectual disability has replaced the word retarded in most cases. There has recently been a campaign, you might have heard of it, called, quote, R word, spread the word to end the word, end quote, that has sought nationally to take this word out of our national shared vocabulary. And finally, in 2010, President Obama did sign a bill officially replacing the word retarded with intellectual disability. So certainly journalists should follow suit. The word insane, apart from lumping together people with emotional or psychiatric disability, this word has also taken on a hue of insult and dehumanization. Consider the fact that about one-third of us will at some point in our lives have a diagnosis of psychiatric disability of some form. This term will hopefully start to fall out of our parlance. Lame and crippled are pretty obvious. There are two other words to avoid when talking about people with mobility disabilities. And finally, deaf and dumb has fallen into disuse for obvious reasons. Clearly, people with hearing impairments are not dumb. So even though most people know that dumb in this context doesn't refer to intellectual issues but refers to speaking issues, the word still evokes images that are insulting and inaccurate. So those are some words and phrases to avoid in all situations. Let's go on to the third point on the next slide. And this point has to do with understanding people with disabilities as people, not as objects of inspiration or as sources of pity. The key point here for this third point is that people with disabilities should not be held to a higher moral standard. Some are brave and courageous, and some are not, just like the rest of people. And the key word here is object. When we assume that people with disabilities should be held up as some sort of source of inspiration that make others feel inspired or maybe make others feel thankful for what they have, we're doing this at the expense of the humanity and the full personhood of people with disabilities. Let's explore this a little bit more on the next slide. And I don't know if any of you are Disney fans, but what we see here is the Hunchback of Notre Dame is sort of being emblematic of the pity and heroism paradigm around disability. Is a character who embodies both the sort of pitiful and tragic hero. But we need to ask ourselves, how many kids who watched that movie could tell you what, I think his name was Quasimodo, I hope I'm getting this right. I can't remember his name, I'm blanking on his name. But how many could tell you what this character's interests and talents and opinions were? Where was the person? He was so stuck behind being an object of tragedy and an object of pity that he was only a half-human character. So We see here the cost of the pity and heroism paradigm for people with disabilities. On the next slide, similarly, if we go online, we see many images that automatically conjure the belief that people with disabilities are continually longing to escape their disability, are constantly wishing they were someone different than who they are. This assumption, again, which is sort of depicted in the images I'm showing here, is not only morally wrong, it's simply wrong. It's simply inaccurate. For many people with disabilities, the disability is not something they're spending their lives wishing they could escape, but rather they just see the disability as one more part of who they are. They just see themselves as people who do things a little bit differently. They're not constantly living in a wish that they were someone or something different than who they are. So on the next slide, we'll see what happens when you Google disability. You go into Google Images, and you Google the word disability. Now, I did this about 3 weeks ago, so it's probably changed since then. But Robin, if we could have the next slide. There we go. I think Googling images is a really interesting way to sort of take the pulse of how a particular phenomenon is viewed in our shared cultural space. So we see these themes played out in this screen capture, as I said, that I took about 3 weeks ago. You can try this yourself. Might have changed a little bit. But we see here this sort of wish to be free. We see in some images like an anguish. We see a medical view of disability often, and we also see here lots and lots of wheelchairs. We have the assumption that disability always means using a wheelchair or involves an obvious disability. As I mentioned before, arguably the majority of people defined as having a disability under the ADA have disabilities that are not obvious to others, such as mental illness, MS, or seizure disorder. So an interesting exercise to sort of understand how disability is not just a medical issue, it's a social construct. It's a concept that is constructed in a social realm and has a particular meaning. So getting away from just the medical conceptualization of disability and understanding disability as a social construct. If we go to the next slide, we see that this slide summarizes the subtle but powerful negative messages that are often implied by the turn of phrases, the language that we use to report on disability. The last statement on this slide is most important. This automatic mindset about disability has cost people with disabilities innumerable jobs, opportunities, and independence. So these phrases and images are not just impolite. They've contributed to a situation where people with disabilities are all automatically seen as less than. And this has, in turn, cost people with disabilities. It's hurt them. So using correct and respectful terminology isn't about just being nice. It has real impact on the lives of people with disabilities. So the subtle but powerful messages that are behind some of the words that we use to report about disabilities hold people with disabilities to a higher moral standard. The disability eclipses the person. It's made all about the disability. It kind of assumes that people with disabilities are desperately wishing they were quote-unquote normal. It brings about the idea that if someone with a disability can do it, anyone can. And probably all of you on the phone remember Jerry Lewis and the Jerry's Kids program and so on. But not many of you remember what these kids really wanted in their life. What were their talents? What were their interests? What were their strengths? What were their skills? All you probably saw, or all that was meant to be seen in that case, was a disability. So moving on to the next slide, we go to our fourth point. About disclosure, ask before you tell. So the fourth point has to do with the law. We previously talked mostly about the language and the respect issue around disability language, but there are legal issues as well that reporters and journalists need to know about. The ADA gives people with disabilities certain rights around whether or not they wish to disclose their disability to others. So the most important point here for journalists and reporters is never assume you know how someone with a disability wants the disability to be portrayed, or even if at all. Is the person's disability relevant at all to the topic of the article? So be careful about not making assumptions. Always ask before you tell or before you make a decision about how to portray a disability. The next slide talks about the finer points of disability disclosure. For legal and human reasons, never disclose a person with a disability without their permission. Ask the person you're interviewing or the person who's going to be reported about how and whether they want a disability to be portrayed. Some people don't want it to be portrayed. Some really do want it to be portrayed, and many are somewhere in between. And again, always consider the role of disability in the story. Is it really relevant to the story, and is it necessary to introduce it at all? So finally, moving on to the next slide, we have point five. Our final point has to do with the simple question, why is it surprising to others when people with disabilities succeed in their personal or professional life? By treating this as a surprise, journalists implicitly question whether people with disabilities can be successful. That's sort of the underbelly of this statement. On the next slide, excuse me. We continue this, and I'm a big Lucy fan, so I had to get a Lucy picture somewhere in this presentation. But we're asking the question here, why is it so surprising when people with disabilities are successful? This issue is epitomized in this statement that I recently heard at a conference from a man who is a prominent lawyer working for the federal government and a man who also happens to be blind. And he made the statement, I'm a lawyer and I have an obvious disability. So many times I've had people be surprised by this. It's like people are going, wow, he's blind and he can think too. So why is it, don't make it surprising that people with disabilities are successful. On the next slide, we see some other phrases that have fueled the automatic assumption that it's a surprise when people with disabilities are pretty much like anyone else. What's implicit behind these statements is that people with disabilities should be held to a lower standard in their educational lives and their career lives. Though people with disabilities might need accommodations and might need to do some things a little differently sometimes, this is not the same as doing things less well or to a lesser standard. The lawyer we just met in the last slide used the accommodation of speech-to-text software as well as a few other assistive technologies, but he got the job done, and he got it done well, and he got it done on time. His success should not be a surprise. So here are the statements that we typically kind of hear that illustrate this success as a surprise issue with disability. Quote, even though he has a disability, he exercises 3 times a week. Despite being disabled, she completed a college degree. Even though these people have disabilities, they're working just like anybody else. She doesn't let her disability get her down. She shows up for school every day and completes her homework. Well, shouldn't every other student? So why shouldn't a student with a disability? So those are our 5 points. If I could have the next slide, I would like to draw your attention to a new fact sheet that we just have on the National ADA Network. I'd urge you all to take a look at this. This just came out. It's a great fact sheet that sort of goes over many of the points that I just talked about here. It's called Guidelines for Writing About People with Disabilities. I give you the link here. As you see, it's also written in Spanish. So do have a look at that. We give you the link for both of these. Okay, the next slide. And what we'd like to do now is take a short break. This is the end of part one, and we would like to take a short break here to see if we have any questions or thoughts or comments coming in from the chat room and coming in from listeners. And we will all respond to these, not just me. So Robin, what do you hear in the chat box?
Well, first of all, let's ask the operator to give instructions for individuals who might be on the phone who also would like to ask us questions today. So if you would go ahead and give those instructions at this time, and those that are on the webinar platform, if you would like to submit your questions, please go ahead and do that at this time. Operator, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. One moment for questions.
Great. We do have one question that came in that I'll go ahead while we're going through the process here of waiting for people to submit. So this person says that even though we continue to see more progressive mainstream media channels use the words like disabled or handicapped, other than learning experiences like this one, how can we be more effective in reaching media professionals to change how disability is viewed? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you to whoever submitted that. I think that in the process of planning this webinar, all of my co-authors and panelists and myself really thought through this heavily. How can we reach professional journalists who don't typically tap into the sort of reading and literature forms that are in the disability community? So certainly webinars like this are one effort, but I do think we also need to reach out to journalist professional organizations and other venues where journalists tend to come together. I think we also need to reach out to journalism schools in university and colleges with these types of issues. The journalists who are my co-authors, would you guys like to weigh in on this?
Sure, Hannah. This is Mary Kat from Cornell. We would be eager to share the link with anyone who would like that for starters. And I personally would be happy to answer any questions that I might be able to help out with. Because we, as you say, we surely want to reach journalists, and we know how busy journalists are and other communicators. So we appreciate the time anyone has spent today, and hopefully in the future we could be of service to you. And as you saw in the beginning of the presentation today, there was an 800 or toll-free number, rather, that you can call and reach a real live person in the ADA network nationally, and they would probably be able to answer most, if not all, of your questions on terminology, etc. But please do use us as resources as well.
Great. Thanks so much, Mary. Robin, shall we take another? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, this is just Peter Quinn, and I guess one thing just to add to that, especially since I just started at Cornell about 8 months ago, and coming from the background of being at the ABC and NBC affiliates in Binghamton, about an hour south of Syracuse, New York, is that especially in local channels, if you're seeing or hearing some of that wording that wouldn't be appropriate, you can always write into the station as well, whether it be an email or even a phone call. I know, my news director would have taken calls like that. Some will, some won't. But I don't think anyone wants to unnecessarily, offend people. So that would be, one thing to try. When it gets to be more the national level, I guess you could try an email or something like that. But, it's much more difficult to get through to the higher up you go in that case. But certainly the more the local levels, I know I've had, people, whether it be, I don't know if I had that necessarily in, disability-related issues, but on other stories where if someone thought that, the wording was off or they would have wanted, something said in another way, I certainly had people contact me, and I was, more than happy to listen because, like I said, you want to get everything accurate and, things like that.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Peter. And I really appreciate, Peter, that you brought out the fact that, we don't want to say that journalists are mean-spirited or ignorant or anything. The vast majority are not. They're perfectly fine people and intelligent people, but that the subtlety of these languages is really what is often the issue, that not everyone realizes the nuances of these languages. So I want to reiterate that point, that we're not trying to say that journalists are intentionally hurtful or anything like that. So thanks for bringing that up. Robin, should we do we have time for one more question?
Yes, sure. Let's see if there's anybody on the telephone. Were there any questions from the telephone, operator?
Yes, and our first question comes from the line of Danita Okoye. Your line is open.
Danita Applewhite. I'm with White Apple Institute, and we have a radio show entitled Ask Dr. Applewhite. This show is focused on helping people, especially veterans, to change their perception of disabled to differently abled. And I am constantly confronted by many of my colleagues about the fact that are you trying to change the label of disabled again? I mean, we've tried to do that for years, and I'll have to come back at them and say, you know, if just listen to the language again of what I'm trying to promote, is changing the perception of disabled to differently abled. I know we can't change the label. We need the label for the categorization, medical insurance, and whatever. Historically, we have to use that disabled label. But if we can change the perception of how people feel, not only the public, and I think that that's, if you will, just one of the things that I focus on is that we're always talking about the public and how the public sees us. And as a disabled person, as a veteran myself, there's something about the way I see myself, the perception of myself, needed to be changed in order for me to see myself as differently abled. Does that make sense? And I hope I'm adding something to.
Yes, that makes great sense. Thank you so much. And I didn't quite catch your name, Donita, I think.
Yeah, no, that's Applewhite.
Oh, great. Well, thank you.
Apple, yes. All right, okay.
Thank you. And I so much appreciate also that you brought up the veterans issue here, that this is certainly an issue for the approximately one-third of veterans who are returning from their service with a service-acquired disability. So this is a huge issue for veterans, and I'm so glad you brought this up as well. So thank you for that, and your work sounds very, very interesting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Should we take one more question, Robin?
Well, we have a couple comments here. Let me share those with you.
Okay.
One is asking about whether the tips that you included are in any kind of journalist handbook that could be used as a reference. And then someone else I had commented about having these things, reaching out like to APA's style book and editors and things of that nature. Are you aware of any efforts or anything in that area?
It's a wonderful idea. The main effort that I'm aware of is the ADA, writing guidelines that in the about two slides ago that I just showed, that particular brief is very, very good. But I think that what this person is saying and what makes a lot of sense is efforts to communicate outside of the disability community on these issues, and that's something we really do need to do. And this is right now spurring me on to think us five co-authors and perhaps others should get together and really try to write an article that would reach out to the journalism and media community. So those are very, very good points.
Hannah, this is Mary Catt at Cornell. I thought that was a great idea, and thank you to whomever sent those emails in about contacting AP. I think we definitely should do that. I've looked in the AP style book many times, and they don't have much about disability, so it would be great if they would be able to, learn a little bit more. And also, in terms of getting the link to the writing guidelines, I believe it's possible to send a follow-up email to all of our listeners today, and we could...
It's in their handouts, their materials, which they received, and those are all active handouts that they
oh,
have.
Great.
And I just also put it back in to the webinar platform again in the question area. So the information is there. People just need to access it, because everyone does have access to these handouts, and those
super.
Are active links in the handouts.
Yeah, so, and, you know, it is the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, so here's a story idea, everyone, that's practically done. If you are looking for a story or an editorial for the next year, this is a good hook to the 25th anniversary.
Splendid. Great. Wonderful. Well, I see this is a great conversation, and I think we've got a lot of wonderful ideas here, and I really appreciate it. We will have another opportunity to have interaction with the audience at the end of the session, but I think it's looking like now it's probably time to move on to our panel. So we have with us a wonderful panel. I'm really looking forward to their discussion. And again, this is kind of going to be a spontaneous discussion. But we have with us John Robinson. John Robinson is the managing partner and CEO of Our Ability. Our Ability is a company owned and operated by people with disabilities to support people with disabilities. John spent 20 years in broadcast television working at various stations. He's also a motivational and inspirational speaker. In the past 6 years, he's been to Italy and Australia discussing the obstacles that he has overcome. He can speak to many audiences about overcoming obstacles in life, business, or sales. He's the subject of a national documentary shown on PBS titled Get Off Your Knees, The John Robinson Story. And he's authored an autobiography called Get Off Your Knees, A Story of Faith, Courage, and Determination, published by Syracuse University Press. He was named a White House Disability Employment Champion of Change in 2014. And in 2015, his business called Our Ability was recognized at the Small Business Excellence Awards as the Small Business of the Year. So we are absolutely delighted to have John with us. We're also delighted to have Peter Quinn with us. Before I move on, though, John, you wanted just to say hello so people can know what you sound like?
Hello.
Okay, great. We also have Peter Quinn, who joined Cornell University's in what's now called the Yang and Tang Employment and Disability Institute, as he said, about 8 months ago in January 2015, as a multimedia editor supporting our web and video-related projects. And previously, as he mentioned, he worked for WIVT and WBGH News Channel 34 in Binghamton in New York State, where he served as an anchor, reporter, and videographer for the news department. So, Peter, you want to say hello real quick so people know your voice?
Hi.
Okay. And I'm hoping we have Allison Weiner-Heinemann with us at this point. She was going to be a little bit late because she had to teach a class, but I believe she should be with us now.
I am, yes.
Oh, hi, Allison.
Hi.
Allison holds a PhD from Yale University, and she's a lecturer in the Department of Labor Relations, Law, and History at Cornell University School of Industrial Labor Relations, or ILR. She teaches an introductory disability studies course, as well as disability-focused writing seminars in the disability studies sequence at ILR. Her research areas lie in disability studies, pedagogy, disability law, and disability culture. So we are so pleased to have these panel members with us for this spontaneous discussion. We will go in the order of John Robinson. We'll go first with about a 5-minute or so opening statement. Then we'll have Allison giving us an opening statement, and finally Peter giving us the 5-minute or so opening statement. And then we will simply open it up to a discussion between panelists, and then finally between panelists and you audience members. On the next slide, if we could have the next slide. These are kind of the basic questions and issues panelists will touch upon. What are the major issues and challenges or dilemmas you see when disability is reported in the media? What are some real-life examples of this? what is the mindset or assumptions that give rise to these issues, and what might need to happen to bring about change. So with that, I am going to have the pleasure of turning this over to our three panelists, and John, you can start.
5 minutes on the clock. Here we go. thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's always nice to share stories and maybe more importantly to answer questions because, you know, it's my personal belief the way we learn is to ask and answer questions with compassion and love and kindness, but that is how you learn. And, you know, we all want to live in a better place. It's funny right now, we at Our Ability, we mentor people with disabilities towards employment, and we're going to be creating a large network towards employment around the state very soon and announce that. But for the past three or four years, in some of the towns across the state, we're very well known as being two individuals with disabilities who are hand cycling across the state along the Erie Canal Path. And we're proud to do it. It's a great way to raise awareness, and we enjoy it very much. But it has opened our eyes to how the media, and I being a former person of the media, can look at us. As was mentioned in my bio, I worked for 15-plus years in broadcast television and know the media very well. But once you're on the other end of the camera, then other people are deciding how they write about you. And, you know, me as a quadruple congenital amputee, you know, I personally have to have a grain of think about it and be careful and not worry too much about what people say, but I have watched it happen. I am a congenital amputee. I am an individual with a disability. I'm proud of that. I enjoy it. I like it very much. But at times, I'm other things in the media. When we took off from Buffalo this past year, leaving for a hand cycle trip, there was an article written about us in a very large newspaper, and the headline is Disabled Bicyclists Take Off on Statewide Trek. That's how it begins, Disabled Bicyclists. And then in the lead, it's two disabled bicyclists. And then it's John Robinson, who was born with stumps for arms. Well, I have arms. They're amputated at the elbow, but they're not stumps. They're not tree stumps, so that I don't necessarily need. And my partner, Doug Hamlin, is a quadriplegic since 1883. So Doug and I have enjoyed, certainly on this bike trip specifically, we enjoyed calling each other those words, me being stumpy. And Doug, we had as having a mistress. The mistress's name is quadriplegia. Now, my wife, Andrea, and Doug's wife, Pam, also got into it a little bit. But you realize that you're labeled based on what people read and write. And while we had fun with it, the truth of the matter is there are people in Western New York that read that and think that I have stumps for arms and think that the only way to describe Doug is quadriplegia. And that's not right. And we have to be cognizant of that and aware of that. It's also very humbling being the public individual and being dependent upon what is written about you. Presently, what's going on in the Syracuse area, they are paving a section of the canal, and we have been proponents of paving the canal to create accessibility for other people with disabilities, and we're very passionate about it. And it's been interesting to watch the comments on the opinion page really yelling at us, calling us names, because we're standing up for something. And it's very easy for people to do that behind an alias, behind a hidden profile. And you watch what the general public really think. And so you realize that comes from, in some part, from how the media portrays you. And so those are two very real life examples, and you can look them up online, and I'm hopefully portraying them fairly. But we have to be aware of what the mindsets are. We at Our Ability, as two people and growing people with individuals with disabilities, we have to be aware that people are watching us. and we need to start talking about how we can change things. And the best way to change things is by explaining exactly who I am. I'm a quadruple congenital amputee, born without the extension of my arms and my legs. Doug is an individual with a disability, an individual with who has quadriplegia, who broke his neck in a trampoline accident 27 years ago. Doesn't mean, you know, Doug also owned and sold a business and has been married for 30 years. So, you know, this is who we are. We are not defined by our disability, but we certainly, you know, are people with disabilities and as part of themselves, and that's okay. That is my 5 minutes.
Oh, well, thank you, John.
I will leave it there for questions later.
Okay, thank you. That was some really wonderful examples of real life issues, and I really appreciate your candor and your willingness to share those with us from somebody who is a person who has worked in the media. So thanks for those wonderful insights. Now we have Allison. Would you like to get us started, Allison?
Sure, and I hope I will very much keep to the 5 minutes, but I can definitely save some for further discussion. So thank you. I just want to reiterate John's words of thanks for the invitation to participate today. And I want to speak from the perspective of a disability scholar and educator. And as such, I find the area of media and representation to be incredibly crucial because, as I convey to my students, we can make important gains in law and policy, which they learn about, but until we see changes in social attitudes, which media informs and is informed by, we don't truly begin to combat discrimination against people with disabilities. And today, so just briefly, I wanted to touch upon the role and importance of social media. I myself am an avid social media user, as many of us are. In fact, recent estimates this year identify that about 45% of the world's population are active internet users. And when it comes to social media and disability, you know, there's a bit of a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, you have the problem of social media in both reflecting and generating the kinds of damaging stereotypes that you went over in the first part of the webinar, not to mention the very issue of social media's accessibility or inaccessibility. But what's also really noteworthy about social media is that it has the potential to transform what constitutes news, right? So what we think is newsworthy in the first place, or who gets to define what is newsworthy. And so I wanted to just highlight briefly as examples. I was struck by, and I was struck that my students were struck by this, because there were two trending stories on Facebook. This was this past May, so not very long ago. And it's really interesting to see which kinds of stories, you know, trend on these kinds of social media platforms like Facebook or Twitter, right? So what becomes designated as viral, and why, right? And what impact this has on really informing social perceptions of whatever the material is on, and in this case, disability. And there were two really striking examples at the same time. So on the one hand, there was a story about an individual, a customer with a disability, who frequented a fast food chain called Qdoba. It offers Mexican-style food. And if you Google Qdoba, and that's Q-D-O-B-A, and disability, the story will come up. And so this customer likes to frequent the restaurant and apparently needs assistance in entering the establishment. She apparently takes paratransit to get there, assistance in getting through the line. And a particular employee has routinely helped her. And apparently she has also requested assistance from this employee in helping her to eat. So on one occasion, another customer at the Qdoba witnessed this and actually videotaped it and sent this to his friends, one of which sent it to the local news syndicate. And from there, it actually made national headlines. And if you Google this, you can find pieces from USA Today and CNN, and then it became a trending story from there on outlets like Facebook and Twitter, which is where I first came across it. And I think the story is really troubling for a few reasons. First, it begs the question of why this is making national headlines. Why is it newsworthy that a person who happens to have a disability and who also needs assistance with tasks like feeding herself enjoys eating at a certain fast food establishment? And, you know, you ask, well, what could make headlines is the fact that the restaurant is so physically inaccessible to this customer. As we discover in one of the pieces, that she has to actually wait outside in the parking lot until someone notices her and brings her in, or that she has to rely on a restaurant employee to assist her with eating because there's a dearth of quality, affordable attendants who can make independent living a reality for people with disabilities. But that's not what's making the headlines. It's the story about a person in need of pity, a person who is in need of charity, and going to the extent where the person who's assisting her, you know, is an inspirational hero. And I certainly don't mean to knock his actions, and they were solicited, so they weren't presumptive. But, you know, but this is very much the rhetoric that is coding this kind of story. You know, and as one of the headlines reads, Qdoba employee feeds customer with disability, reminds us all to help someone today. The other story, and this was especially problematic because this is trending at the same time, so was about a nursing student at Misericordia University in Pennsylvania. You can also Google this. Misericordia is Misericordia. And a nursing student who is suing the institution for failing to appropriately accommodate her, as the law requires, her anxiety, depression, and functional limitations in concentrating during a final exam. And this was actually a mainstream news piece. It was run by outlets like the Washington Post, and relatively objectively, but then for some reason became a kind of viral story that got shared and reposted and shared. And what was really striking was a lot of the commentary, this kind of a really discriminatory animus. You know, she can't hack it, she's not qualified, accommodations are bogus anyway, this kind of language. And what's really striking then is that you've got these two examples that are trending at the same time, right? So people are actually finding these news stories about disability intriguing enough to be sharing them and writing about them, but it's either distilled to an image of a person with a disability who's in need of pity or a person who is to be vilified and is made suspect because she needs accommodations. So I think that was really striking. But at the same time, social media can also offer a platform for really educating, for debunking some of these problematic stereotypes. So as many people who were sharing the Misericordia nursing student story and were, you know, vilifying her, there were many who were speaking out and saying, you know what, we need a greater awareness of what accommodations mean. We need a greater awareness of what happens when institutions like this fail to accommodate students as the law requires and should be going beyond just mere compliance too. And disability scholars have talked about how social media can be a real platform for activism and advocacy too. And there have been noteworthy examples, especially in the UK, in protesting some of the austerity cuts. And so, you know, launching Twitter campaigns, and they've gone viral and they've actually made a huge difference. So I'm struck by that kind of double-edged sword of media, specifically when we look at social media, that on the one hand, you know, it really reifies these kinds of stereotypes, but on the other hand, we do have a possible platform to challenge them.
Great. Thank you so much, Allison. Really interesting. I think what you said really kind of echoed what we had said earlier in the presentation about this sort of the twin parallel trends of pity on the one hand and vilification on the other. And thank you so much for bringing in the element of social media that really brings in a new wrinkle in the new nuance in the discussion. So thank you so much.
Right, thank
Peter.
You.
Peter.
Yes, I'm here. And I mean, just a few points, I guess. I really like what both John and Allison had to say. And I guess just a few points from my perspective, especially with just recently coming out of you know, the news media field, one of the things that I would observe for whether it be reporters who would be listening today or perhaps people with different organizations or agencies that work with people who have disabilities is that, you know, when I was out in the field, a lot of times, you know, a certain percentage of our stories had to do with disability, not a large percentage, but certainly some. And especially if I was around other reporters and, you know, they came across someone perhaps who was using a wheelchair or whatever the disability, especially if it was very visible. Sometimes they would not really be sure how to act, or, you know, do you help someone out, or what do you say? Or all of a sudden there was like this mental block that went up that was like, oh, well, they're different than me. And I think the one thing that, you know, I learned over the years there, and then that's really just been reinforced, you know, at the ADA, working with the Northeast ADA Center, is that people really are just people. You know, some people, maybe someone has a disability or a different ability. Someone perhaps, you know, doesn't. But it really is people are just people. And people do want to share stories. You know, if they're willing to talk, then they're not really necessarily concerned with, you know, if they're going to be seen in a wheelchair or something like that, you know, when they're essentially for television. So that would just be the main point of don't worry about shying away from people who, someone maybe that looks different, people are just people. Another thing would be for people who are perhaps work with organizations or agencies that help people with disabilities. Sometimes I've heard, well, I don't know, yeah, I can't get coverage for something, or you know, you never cover this event when I was at the station, or you never really, you know, focus on, you know, A, B, or C. And I would say that, you know, don't hesitate to reach out to media organizations. Especially I'm speaking more at the local level. The Binghamton market is a smaller television market, so I wasn't in New York City, which may be a little more difficult to access some of the newsrooms and get their attention. But certainly in a lot of these markets, if you can put together a you know, press event or a news conference, you know, at least in the Binghamton market, we would show up if at all possible. And certainly having visuals there for – it is television after all, so, you know, just – sometimes you show up and you just have one person to interview and there was nothing to film as far as to help tell the story. Well, that got to be kind of problematic because then what do you show for the video? But a lot of times, especially like the Southern Tier Independent Center in Binghamton did a great job of organizing news conferences and to get their message out. There would be certain you know, hot button topics in the Binghamton area that would be going on, such as the Broome Developmental Center, which basically was just an institution for people with intellectual disabilities, and the state is in the process of shutting that down. So the Southern Tier Independent Center reached out to the media through letters, through news conferences and things of that nature to basically get their message out. It's one of the things that can be very difficult, especially when you're on deadline pressure, is to make a lot of phone calls. Or sometimes you call up someone to try to get the other side of a story, and then you have to leave a message, and then they don't call you back until later. So if you are an organization who can reach out, whether it be to the news director or the assignment editor, or if you know a reporter, or if you can make contact with a reporter, to say, listen, if you're going to do a story about whatever the issue is, you know, I would be happy to provide, whether it be a statement, an interview, so you can kind of balance the story out so you have both sides. And then just to be available that day. If someone calls you up to say, hey, you know, we're doing this story, you know, come on over. Or if you can't do it, then have someone else that's available to do that interview for the station. And I guess just the last thing that I would say is, you know, as far as the webinar today, I think I guess the way that I had been looking at it is, and Hannah had already kind of referenced this, is that, you know, no one's trying to force anyone to use necessarily certain language. It's really a matter of respect. And I know every now and then at the station I would have certain companies that would try to basically write my story for me. And it's, no, we're not going to do that. And, you know, I need to break this down more and whatever the case is. But this isn't about trying to control what wording that you're using. It's just really about respecting individuals. And I think, you know, just two quick examples would be, I was at a conference earlier this year and I was talking to a gentleman who had a, it wasn't a visual disability, but he had a disability. And he was just sharing with me, he goes, you know, one of the things that really gets me angry, and he really emphasized the term angry, is when people use the term retarded. And, you know, we just got talking a little more about this, and he goes, yeah, it really just diminishes the value of these, of people and their contributions and things like that. And I never really had thought about it like that before. I didn't use the term, but at the same point, I guess that just really wasn't crossing my mind as far as what impact that actually had on people. And I'm thinking, gosh, if I was still at the station, not just the term retarded, but other words, too, that perhaps would be offensive to people, you know, I don't want to unnecessarily offend someone. Sometimes people take exception with the stories that you're doing, and they can get angry or upset because they don't like the way it was, or even it was a negative story about them because they had done something wrong, or whatever the case is. But, you know, if you're just reporting on something, I don't want to anger part of my viewing audience. And that was something that really just had made an impact on me. So I guess those are just a few points that I just wanted to bring up, and I guess I'll stop talking so I guess the discussion can, you know, go on.
Great. Thank you so much, Peter, for, again, your valuable insights as being both, you know, working with disabilities with us here at Cornell and then also being as part of the trenches as a media professional. So thank you so much. Well, that brings us right up to, we wanted to leave 15 minutes to allow our audience members to pose questions and to, you know, have a discussion between our audience members and all three of our wonderful panelists that we have here today. So, Robin, are there any questions currently in the question box?
Well, there's actually a comment. We'll have the operator give instructions again to the individuals on the phone, and so we can have them remember how to ask questions again. So, operator, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Great. Thank you. We have somebody who made a comment. I'll just review the comment because I think it's relative. It was part of the first discussion, but also, I think, relative throughout. They were actually making a note about statistics and the numbers that our users cited often about people with disabilities in the United States through various surveys. And they're really making the point that the surveys really only take into account those that are actually living in the community and not those that are actually living in institutionalized settings. And it can lead to a significant difference in the numbers of individuals with disabilities. Again, this is a comment. For the surveys being used by the Census Bureau, the definition of disability falls into different categories: visual, hearing, mobility, cognitive, self-care, and independent living. But just looking at those, it doesn't really capture those things that are hidden disabilities. So I think they just make a good point about knowing and using statistics out there related to that.
Yeah, and that's also, I'm glad this person brought that up. We have the 1 in 5, the 20%. You might notice that there are different statistics around the number of people with disabilities. That this varies widely. That 20% mark tends to include the number of people with disabilities who have a disability as it's defined by the ADA. If there are other definitions of disability used, we could get a very different number. But generally, we like to use the ADA one. So thanks for that comment. Great. Any other comments or thoughts or questions, Robin?
Yeah, there. And then we'll go to the telephone, see if there's any there. There's another comment that's asking, and I think this would be interesting to hear what your panelists have to say, is they're saying in today's political climate, with the whole issue of political correctness and such, how do you either define or defend political correctness as it relates to the use of terminology and people with disabilities?
Interesting question. Would any of our panelists like to jump in on that one?
This is Mary Kat. I would defend anything that is, done with respectfulness, as Peter says. I don't think that there's a standard PC this or that in the world of disability language that's widely accepted, but I would say that if someone is authentically trying to be helpful, that most people would respect that.
Great. Thanks, Mary. Any other panelists?
We'll go to the – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. But anybody else wants to chime in on that?
Anybody else want to chime in? John or Peter or
– Yeah, it's John. I think the best journalists are the ones that ask. You know, ask about it instead of trying to label it on their own. And I think then it gives me the opportunity to be able to answer it. You know, we all live in a politically correct world right now. And I think when we can ask what the person wants or expects, then I think we're in a better place. And that's something that we should be aware of.
Great. Thanks. All right. Robin, would you like to go on? You said you had another question?
No, I was going to actually find from the operator. Do we have any questions from those individuals that are on the telephone at this time, please?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star and one. One moment for questions. And I believe we have a follow-up from Danita Applewhite. Your line is open.
Hello?
Unmute. Please unmute it.
Okay, I'm here now. I just wanted to ask a question to the panelists. And that is, I had mentioned a little earlier that my work in the media, especially in the radio, I'm constantly having veterans call in, especially veterans, call in a lot of non-veterans. And what I'm still hearing, and I just want to know what your comments are on what I said, is that, yes, we have to change the attitudes and perceptions of the public, but there's also, do you feel that there's also a need for the individual with disability to understand what perception they have about disability and to be able to know what questions to ask? Because many of the people that I'm dealing with don't even understand what accommodations are needed.
Great question. Thanks, Donita. And that's actually this issue, you're bringing up an issue that we really haven't touched upon yet, and what is the role of people with disabilities themselves in changing how disability is reported. Would any of our panelists like to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I don't mind if John, again, obviously a person with a disability, and it's obvious and visible. I think I have a responsibility to represent myself in the best way and to be an example for others. But it also gives me an opportunity to preach a little bit to other people with disabilities and say it is how we represent ourselves. It is how educated we are. It is how comfortable we are. And if we present ourselves in a way that is open, welcoming, then people will treat us, the way we want to be treated. It is equal, and I say this all the time in my any talk that I give, either privately with people with disabilities or the general audience, it's equally my responsibility how the world sees me as it is the world. And I truly believe that. And if we stand up and are better and stronger with each other, and honest with one another, then we're going to, those numbers at the very beginning of this webinar will go down, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, great.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Can you hear me say thank you?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, I just want, because you're reinforcing one of the principles that I use, and that's be the change we want to see in the world, and that's from Mahatma Gandhi. And I think that that's applicable to all of us who are dealing with any form of disability, especially non-visible, that we need to be that change first. And
you know what?
Can impact.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Go back to the story that I illustrated about either what the Buffalo paper called us or the argument that we're having with the general public right now in Syracuse. You know, if I went on our soapbox and said, it needs to be paved because I need to be able to use it, or how dare you call me Stumpy, then that would make me look poor. And it would also, in turn, make other individuals with disabilities look poor. That's not what we said. you know, what we're trying to say is we deserve equality. We deserve our half the responsibility to ask for that equality. But it is, you know, equally our responsibility, and that's what we feel is very important.
I wanted to also ask Allison, you know, who's looked at social media and disability, which is such an interesting, you know, emerging issue. It seems like in social media that people with disabilities have many more venues now and a better platform to reframe the concept and discussion of disability. But in the example that you gave, particularly the one with the nursing students, that wasn't happening. Do you see that happening in social media of people with disabilities using social media to reframe the discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's very much, and this is why it's such an important platform to consider, is because it does allow people with disabilities an incredibly crucial venue to change the conversation. So as I said earlier, to actually start defining what is the news and what is newsworthy and retelling the story, as it were. And so as I had briefly mentioned, I kind of glossed over these examples at the end, but I was referring to the UK Twitter campaign, which really helped make political change in the face of governmental austerity cuts. There's also a really great campaign on Facebook. It's called This Is What Disability Looks Like, and it's run by people with disabilities, and it's about, you know, really refuting this dichotomization that I talked about, you know, and getting, this is a point that Peter raised too, it's about, you know, people with disabilities do everyday things, right? And we just, when people are represented in these really troubling extremes, we elide the everydayness of life, and we refuse people with disabilities the right to be everyday citizens. So it becomes an incredibly powerful tool for people with disabilities to actually change the conversation from within, and that's why we have to really ensure social media accessibility too, because that's a huge issue. These very important platforms aren't even accessible in most cases. Like a recent survey said that, you know, about a third of social media sites are actually accessible by screen reading technology. But at the same time, I also really want to emphasize, and I really emphasize this as an educator too, we have many students with disabilities in the disability study sequence, but those, you know, we have people, students who don't have disabilities, and it's about teaching them to be global citizens, especially in the world of work. And the onus, you know, has to be on non-disabled people. It can't be entirely on people with disabilities. And so that, you know, it needs to be a matter of using venues like social media to, as a tool to educate, to really be able to debunk the kinds of stereotypes and problematic conversations that are happening, and to use, you know, to share posts like these, but to change the conversation. So I think it can be an incredibly important platform for people with disabilities, but it needs to be a shared responsibility. It cannot be a sole task by any means.
Great. Thanks, Allison. Peter, you, in your, you know, statement that you had made, you talked about sort of issues around the comfort level of reporters and you know, gaining trust and so on. Would you like to weigh in on this issue of what the role of people with disabilities are in this in the media?
Sure. I mean, I think, I just agree, you know, especially going back to what John was saying, and, you know, I kind of relied on, if someone doesn't have a disability, they're really not thinking about disability. The average person out there, and especially the average reporter for the most part. So that's why if I was kind of encouraging people, if they can reach out, to do so, because I certainly had people do that to me, and it really made me just, you know, kind of stop and think and kind of put myself in someone else's shoes and kind of change the way that I, approached certain stories. I remember there was his name was Rick Yarish, who was in the Army, and he lives in a nearby town from Binghamton, and he was burned over 60% of his body after being hit with a bomb. And he's a motivational speaker now and goes into schools and, to companies. And I was going to interview him one time, and we had about 15 minutes before the event started, and I'd already done my one-on-one interview with him. And we just started talking. And, I mean, he is visually scarred from being burned. And, you know, a lot of people, when they first look at him, it's like, oh, wow. And they're kind of taken back. And we just started talking, and we were laughing and just chatting about, you know, whatever. And I think if, you know, the more, you know, people just, you know, reach out and the more their connections that can be made, all of a sudden you really start forgetting that this person has a disability. Especially if you don't have a disability yourself, you really just start forgetting that. And I guess that's what we're looking for, and that really that people are people. And there doesn't have to be all these lines drawn, because there shouldn't be. But just I think the way society has functioned in the past, you know, it just has gone that way.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Well, we have a couple, 3 minutes left. Robin, are there any other questions or comments in the chat box or any on the phone?
Well, let's check one more time with the operator to see whether or not there's anybody else who has asked for anything on the phone. And then otherwise, I do have one more that's kind of a follow-up to what you've already been talking about. So,
right.
See, operator?
And I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Great. So your discussion of social media has brought somebody to submit a question here. So with, you know, talking about social media and how it's used and such, but there's a great deal of inaccessibility in social media, mm-hmm. And it's not fully accessible. So do you have any suggestion of any workarounds or anything that people can work from? Or, I mean, sometimes the workarounds can be kind of cumbersome too, but do you have any suggestions of how we can really, you know, engage? It's not just about how we write about people with disabilities or we use social media for these things, but it's also how do people then access it at the same time, if that's going to be the medium that we're going to use to convey and discuss these issues.
Yeah.
Great. Great question.
I mean, there needs to be just a larger conversation. There needs to be awareness of the sheer inaccessibility of these platforms. I think there's this assumption that, oh, you know, with today's technology, this must be accessible. And there's not a recognition of different ways in which people need to process and access information. So there was actually a conference that the FCC held. It was last year. It was in 2014. And it was, you know, to begin to really start to address this issue. But what it ended up doing was illustrating just how abysmal the state of social media accessibility is, because representatives from the major social media outlets like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter didn't even show up. The only representative from a major social media platform was LinkedIn. That was the one exception. So, you know, we don't even have the social media organizations, you know, responding to this. So, I mean, there are definitely campaigns actually using social media platforms. You know, and I know Martley Matlin has been a really powerful spokesperson for the deaf community, you know, using her Twitter account to, you know, call out Netflix, call out YouTube, hey, these things are inaccessible. So, you know, again, you have people who can use platforms using them, but it needs to be just a greater conversation. There needs to be a governmental push, and there needs to be real accountability from these organizations themselves to actually do something about this.
Great. Thank you so much, Allison. And I want to, we're 1 minute over time right now. I want to thank our panelists, Allison Weiner-Heinemann, Peter Quinn, and John Robinson. I hear in cyberspace a huge applause right now for you. Thank you very much. I know I learned a lot from listening to you, and it was very, very interesting. If we could go on just very quickly, we have, this is just a slide that shows John Robinson's Our Ability and how to find John Robinson's Our Ability. If you want to contact any of us who were authors, on this presentation, call this 800 number, 949-4232. Again, that's the Northeast ADA Center. Call it either to reach us or to have any question related to disability or disability in the media answered. You can talk with live experts at that number. And as always, we are closing in on our time. Thank you so much to all of my co-authors and collaborators with this. Thanks to Robin for sponsoring us. And most of all, thanks to all of you for your interest in this very, very important topic. We hope to hear from you again in the future. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, and thank you to all of Hannah and to all of the great panelists and speakers today. We do want to thank you for participating in the ADA Audio Conference Series. Just as a heads up, the next scheduled session is October 20th of 2015, and our focus will be on social media and accessibility. So it's kind of a nice, interesting follow-up to this particular last ending of the conversation today. So again, hope you can join us. For those of you that we do value your opinions and such, you will receive a follow-up email after this session, which will include a link to an online survey. We do value your opinion. Please feel free to fill that out. If you would like a certificate of attendance for today, there will be instructions related to that, as well as how you can access a transcript and such of today's session at a later date if you missed anything or you want to go back to it or want to refer somebody else to this information. So again, thank you. You can hang up the phone if you're on the telephone, and if you're in the webinar platform, all you have to do is just close your browser and you will be exiting the program. So again, thank you everyone, and have a great rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.